Welcome to Not Artificially Sweetened, a weekly podcast where we reflect on all things diabetes. Your hosts are specialist physician Stan Landau and diabetes specialist nurse Michael Brown. We are passionate about using our talents to change lives for the better. Our mission is to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Nothing is off the table here as we discuss real people, their real issues and stories, and together discover real answers to many vexing practical issues in diabetes and its management.
Welcome everybody to episode 47 of Not Artificially Sweetened. This episode is brought to you by the CDE Online Pharmacy. The potential reduction in medication burden and costs, and even the remission of diabetes, is now a realistic aspiration for many people with type 2 diabetes, especially those who've been recently diagnosed and who are able to lose excess body fat, resulting in weight loss of 15 kilograms or more. The CDE Online Pharmacy is pleased to introduce to you the growing range of CDE MyWell reduced calorie products, currently in the form of very low kilojoule meal replacement shakes in three delicious flavors. Backed by sound research evidence, the CDE MyWell range, when used in conjunction with a medically supervised lifestyle program, is specifically designed for use in therapeutic, very low calorie diets to assist in reducing the clinical and physiological burden of and risks associated with dysfunctional excess body fat. Hello, Michael Brown.
Hi there, Stan. Great to be back. We've just been through Human Rights Day. Hope you had a good holiday yesterday.
I had an amazing holiday, and we're happy to join our listeners here today. Listeners, remember, you can find us on our four top platforms, Spotify, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, and the Listen mobile audio app. We've got a full show today, Michael, with some interesting and diverse talks. And as you heard there from the intro, something quite exciting in the works and already in the marketplace.
Yes, the CDE has worked with Back to Basics Nutrition to develop a range of CDE MyWell reduced calorie products. We're going to be unpacking these products and their place in the management of type 2 diabetes over the next few weeks and how it should be incorporated into a professional approach to the management of this condition.
I think there's a very important point here. If you're going to give adult men and adult women less than half of their total calorie intake per day, keeping them feeling full and not having that hunger feeling is clearly a key mandate here. You wouldn't go half a day. You could eat your left arm, so to speak. So I think it's very important for healthcare professionals who may be endorsing a very low calorie diet, or perhaps somebody with diabetes is looking to kick their diabetes into touch or attain a remission. But that's a very key point. The other key point, which is probably lost in translation here, but I'll spell it out for everybody, is that this really is under the supervision of a registered dietitian. You shouldn't be cutting 50% or more of your total daily intake done as a kind of a willy-nilly on the side of something that's fashionable and one of these day-by-day diets, so to speak. The word diet is tagged on here, but it's much more than that. This is a metabolic intervention with a deliberate purpose of achieving remission, maintaining remission of a big diagnosis, type 2 diabetes. And I can't stress it enough. I think the key message for me here is it must be done under medical supervision.
To reiterate what Stan has said, this is not a meal replacement that is used to prepare for a friend's wedding or your own wedding in 5 weeks' time. This is a proper medically supervised nutritional intervention to help us deal with the metabolic effects of type 2 diabetes. So we just celebrated Human Rights Day in South Africa. This is a day where we recognize and celebrate rights that everyone should have simply because they're human. On Human Rights Day, South Africans are asked to reflect on these rights, to protect their rights and the rights of all people from violation, irrespective of race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, whether they're foreign national or not. Human rights apply to everyone equally. South Africa has included indivisible human rights in our own Bill of Rights, these being Chapter 2 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. The Bill of Rights embeds the rights of all people in our country in an enduring affirmation of the democratic values of human dignity, equality, and freedom. Now, some of the protected rights include a healthy environment, housing, healthcare, food, water, and social security. Now, all that the bill says in Section 27(1)(a) is that everyone has a right to healthcare services, including reproductive healthcare. And I looked at that and I thought, wow, it's not very specific and not very broad. I just wonder if this right is actually being protected. And I'll just throw it out there that in this country, diabetes specialist nurses are not recognized for their incredible speciality. Stan, what do you think about this in context of Human Rights Day?
I think it's a very important point because amongst the prospects of the emergence of national health in our country, diabetes has become the next big thing. We've spoken on this podcast before about having kind of defeated, in inverted commas, the HIV pandemic. So we've moved on to non-communicable conditions such as type 2 diabetes. And even within that, we're beginning to see this enormous chasm open up between what may be enshrined in the Constitution and what's actually happening at the coalface. It'd be even as simple as the treatment of your advocacy components or your human rights when you go to a clinic and is medication available and are you being treated with good dignity and respect? So diabetes for me fits very, very nicely into this narrative. And, you know, Michael, for lack of a better word, it's doable.
Right. Thanks, Dan. This is something for our advocacy partners to look at. Is this access to the right of diabetes care being supported and protected in the South African context? Having said that,
let's introduce our advocacy message this week. Kirsten from SA Diabetes Advocacy is on leave, so our friend Lorena Free has happily stepped in to give us her take on outstanding advocacy needs within her experience and community.
I recently found a quote by Dr. Caroline Leaf saying, "Your purpose is not the thing you do. It is the thing that happens in others when you do what you do." And what a great motto when it comes to diabetes advocacy. It is not something that we do to benefit ourselves. It is to better and build the diabetes community inside and out. But I always say it's like glitter. You can't sprinkle the feel-good vibes and knowledge onto other people without getting some of it on yourself too. So let's elevate our advocacy efforts and speak up and spread the facts, because by building the community to a more powerful network, you also build yourself to a more empowered individual.
Thank you so much, Lorena. We appreciate the wisdom that you have shared from your years of living with diabetes, and we look forward to another message from you next week.
Well, time for our studio guest, and we are honored to have with us Jessie Chien, who is a specialist dietitian in pediatric diabetes, and she's hailing to us today from the United Kingdom. Jessie graduated from the University of Cape Town with an honors degree in nutrition and dietetics in 2006, and she served her community service at the Red Cross Children's Hospital. She then moved to the UK in 2008, and there she specialized in pediatric diabetes. Since September 2023, Jessie has a new role as a diabetes technology dietitian for the National Health Service in England. She collaboratively works with all stakeholders within the NHS South East region to provide equitable access to diabetes technologies such as insulin pump therapy, continuous glucose monitoring, and hybrid closed-loop systems for all children and young people. Jessie is passionate, and I love that word. It's a word that has come up many times on our podcast. If you work in diabetes, you have to be passionate. So Jessie is passionate about helping children, young people living with diabetes and their families to navigate the world of food, insulin, and blood glucose management. So Jessie, it's been a long time coming. We've been trying to set this up for probably 6 months and we finally got it together. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Stan, for having me. It's really cool to be talking to you guys today.
Yeah, wonderful.
Michael, before we get into the specifics around pediatric dietetics, we haven't had somebody of this caliber join us with this degree of expertise in this field. It's interesting there you spoke about in her bio there on the equitable access, and we spoke about the human rights components in our own country and perhaps the lack of equity across the spectrum. So, Jessie, you have kind of a foothold in each country. You hail from here and you're working over there. Is it easy to know that there are parts of the globe that lack that equitable access, modern technologies? I mean, we struggle to get insulin to some folk in South Africa, and there your equitable access is pump and CGM.
Yeah.
How does one reconcile that kind of nuance?
I've been in this role with the NHS since September last year. It's been an amazing experience to be able to work with all the teams across the Southeast region. There are 23 teams that we work with, and they're all pediatrics, and the caseload range between 88 patients to 350 patients per team. So what we see in terms of inequalities is that there is digital poverty in this country. There are many families who can't afford a phone to support the use of Libre or Dexcom or the hybrid closed loop systems. So in terms of addressing digital poverty, our role is to find charities across the UK to donate phones to these families. Another barrier in accessing technology would be things like parents not bringing their children to the clinics, and we'll have to find out the reasons behind those episodes. A lot of those reasons could be parents having to work and they don't have time to come to clinic. If they don't go to work, they won't get paid.
So, Michael, what I'm hearing here then is it doesn't matter where you live in the world, that there are always going to be challenges to the management of diabetes. You can be an older person with diabetes, you can be somebody caring for somebody with diabetes, or you could be a parent. There will be challenges, whether it be time-based or financial, even in the developed world, such as in the UK. Jesse, let's explore these themes even further, because it's so interesting to see that we were bemoaning the fact that we don't have recognition in this country of diabetes nurse specialists. You're a dietitian who's specialized in pediatric diabetes. Is there a need? You know, we were taught back in the day when I was at medical school those years ago that children really were just small adults and it didn't have a particular need. Has that mandate changed as dietetics has evolved?
I think so. The care of children and young people living with diabetes is very different to the care of adults. In adult diabetes, there's a lot of complications that could happen, and dietitians would manage those complications, plus all the other things that pediatric dietitians might be doing, such as healthy eating, carb counting, discussions on glycemic index. But in pediatrics, there isn't the aspect of having to deal with complications. But there are also the different developmental stages of childhood. So, for example, from 0 to 2 years of age, babies and toddlers would be having milk, one of their main foods. And that tends to be quite haphazard in terms of routine. And we will tend to then support parents through managing glucose levels with insulin and the whole feeding on demand and snacks in between meals. There's a lot of things that we'll need to support with at that age. For the children who are under 5, they will be more structured, I hope. We tend to teach them to aim for 3 main meals and 2 snacks a day. Under 5s, they tend to be a lot more haphazard in their activity levels as well. During the day, they'll be super busy, or they might be on phones or iPads being entertained while the parents are busy. So we'll need to talk to parents about the effect of activity on glucose levels in conjunction with the meals and snacks. From 5 years onwards, we have primary school children transitioning to big school, high school in South Africa, or secondary school over here. And that's a big change, because over here, they might be going on school dinners, free school meals, and then they have to car count for these school dinners. I'm not sure what happens in the South African schools. I remember packed lunches. So I guess the transition might not be such a big one. And there tend to be a big change from primary to secondary school, where teachers in primary school will be a lot more attentive to a child living with diabetes, whereas when you are released into the secondary school arena, it's much more like a free-for-all, like a young adult type of life. So we prepare children going into that life by ensuring that they take on more responsibility for their diabetes, etc. And then we have the teenagers. We all know teenagers can become a little bit harder to navigate. There's the pressures of teenage life, social life, schoolwork, and then there's the pressures of managing glucose levels. So we support teenagers through that phase of their lives. Mm. And then lastly, we also support them with the transition to the adult diabetes services, where freedom is a big thing. So we'll talk to them about driving, about alcohol, parties, going to university, cooking for themselves. So there is a lot of things that pediatric diabetes dietitians tend to help children and young people with. Yeah.
Right. So it's not just about what to eat, but we've got to remember that these growing new human beings pass through many biological, physical, psychological, social, and cognitive stages of development. And all of those things have an impact on how the person views and interacts with food and their environment. So it's quite a complex task for the specialist pediatric dietitian.
Yes, for sure. And every child is different. Every family is different. So it's important to understand the family background. And this relates to health inequalities as well. Sometimes when I was younger practicing in dietetics, if a child or family does not come to clinic, I will get quite annoyed and quite despondent. But actually learning more about health inequalities, there are things like work pressures, life pressures that is put on families. So I am much more understanding now.
Right.
And what we are encouraged to do is to work with families to help them to attend clinic appointments. So not just face-to-face, we're offering virtual clinic appointments as well. I'm finding that doing virtual appointments after 4:30 is a pretty good time to catch the families, because by then the school's done, the work is done, parents are a little bit more relaxed, and we can have a proper conversation. As a dietitian, we don't do any examinations, so it's all conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Virtual conversations are really helping me get to the families where they need me the most. Yeah.
I think you've raised an important point there about people not attending appointments. While we would prefer that they do attend the appointments, the fact that they didn't attend the appointments is actually giving you some valuable information that for whatever reason, they were not able to. And instead of just writing that off to so-called non-compliance, you have brought up some very important points why work and life issues may actually prevent.
Yes.
So it may not be an act of omission, but rather that I could not get there.
Yes.
Your change in attitude as you've matured in your speciality will help your clients, because at least then you are more willing and able to try and understand where they are coming from.
I want to extend that point, because how often you see adults, perhaps with type 2 diabetes, or even the carers will say off the cuff, well, we've seen the dietitian, we don't need to go back, we know what to eat, and we know what not to eat. But in fact, there's so much more behind that statement, Michael, because unlike the medical examination, which may be focused on pure numeric outcomes, weight, blood pressure, blood glucose levels, examining the feet in that sense, we're learning a lot more about the family dynamic.
You know? Yes.
We're learning about what people can and can't afford. We're learning about their time pressures, and the actual dynamic within that family is so relevant for the management of diabetes that we don't just look at the HbA1c as a single measure and say, well, things are good or bad. It isn't as binary as that. And I constantly remind people of the value that the registered dietitian can bring to the total management of diabetes. And in fact, none more so here in the pediatric population, because things change, as you say, Jesse. What your kid was eating when they were 3 years old doesn't equate to what happens when they go to parties without their parents, perhaps, of a weekend. And they have to carry that knowledge with them, having been well established early on.
It's really rewarding to work with families and see these children grow up. And I think because I've been in pediatrics for so long, I get to know the families, and we can have quite candid conversations, very honest conversations, without the families thinking, oh, the dietitian will just judge me. The dietitian will just tell me to like stop eating sweets and chocolates. But there's always a spectrum of how different dietitians approach their children and young people and their families. Now, I work with type 1 diabetes. 90% of my patient caseload is type 1 diabetes. So when I work with children and young people and their families, I tend to have the motto of diabetes shouldn't control your life. You should be able to live alongside it in a very peace and harmonious way. And no food is a bad food. Every food should be consumed in moderation. So often on diagnosis, families or parents, they'll be very worried about, oh, I must take out all the sweets and chocolates. What must I do when my child goes to a party? What happens during Christmas or Easter? Easter's coming up. Does my child can't have Easter eggs? I will then say Easter, Christmas, parties, birthday parties, they don't happen every day. So there should still be a time for families to enjoy these occasions. So being more flexible on these days is not going to be detrimental to their diabetes. That's the message I try and convey to all the people I work with.
I want to extend that message because we have been blessed over many years to have a very senior registered dietitian work with us, Michelle Daniels. We were lucky when she returned to South Africa, having worked for many years at King's College. And she brought back the DAPHNE program to South Africa. Now, Michael and I were there right from the beginning of Michael Berger's work. For those listeners to the show, or perhaps healthcare professionals, D-A-F-N-E spells DAPHNE, the diet adjustment for normal eating, which Jesse has brought up here, because essentially you could follow a flexible route where you eat and you adjust your insulin for so-called normal eating, perhaps in inverted commas, and then more restrictive approach, perhaps low or no carbs for this. Is there an evidence base that either of these produces better outcomes in the long term? And by outcomes, let's look at blood sugar outcomes, complication outcomes, mental health outcomes. Is one way better than another?
That's very interesting. In pediatric diabetes, where we start our children and young people and their families with carbohydrate counting from diagnosis, as close to diagnosis as we can, I tend to start talking about carbohydrate awareness, carbohydrate counting, within a week of their type 1 diabetes diagnosis. From what I know, when I started, the Roche expert meter was a big thing over here back in 2009, and we saw dramatic improvements in glucose management and time in range back then, when the children and young people transferred from not using a bolus calculator to using a bolus calculator, and also from not carbohydrate counting to carbohydrate counting. So if there is the resources, if there is the understanding, we do promote carbohydrate counting and matching to insulin as soon as possible. And I do find from the parents that I speak with, they say, well, I wouldn't have known how to manage glucose levels if I didn't carbohydrate count.
Sure.
How would I be able to match the insulin to the amount of food my child is eating? It gives more freedom. Yeah.
For sure. Something my parents used to do after a big Sunday lunch and some ice cream was we used to go for a long walk.
Yeah.
And I think that's another way where you don't necessarily restrict what the person's eating, but you just put in a family-based activity that's not exercise per se, but it's getting you moving for a prolonged period of time.
Yes.
Maybe taking the dog or dogs for a walk and doing something together as a family, and then taking the pressure off choosing foods and balancing things like that. I don't know if that's something you would chat to parents about.
Yes, that is such an important aspect of diabetes, to focus on diet and exercise. I think in type 1 diabetes, there's also a lot of parents or children and young people thinking that, oh, as long as I carb count, as long as I give for my insulin, sugars will be perfect. But actually, we know from all the CGMS we have nowadays that it doesn't work like that. There's still the aspect of being active that can improve the glucose management that much more. So with exercise, that is another big topic that I will cover during my consultations. It's usually embedded in my second consultation with the families. And we talk about the effect of exercise on the glucose level, on the body, the long-lasting effect. If you're active for more than 45 minutes, the effect of exercise can last up to 11 hours after. So we'll talk about things like that. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Activity is so important. And I like the fact that you said family involvement is so important. We often forget that even a family walk after dinner or after lunch or during the weekend is so good for the family, for the glucose level, as movement is just not talked about enough.
I want to turn our attention to something that we don't have in this country, and that's the transition clinic from the pediatric service in the UK to the adult. And I want to get a sense of it, because very often parents would have had perhaps 6, 8, 10 years with the pediatric group, very small, intimate, as you say, not associated with complications, transitions to the adult service now, which is a bewildering place full of older people, perhaps people who've already developed complications of their diabetes. What are some of the pitfalls you see in transition where these young kids and perhaps the family as a whole get lost in this bigger entity? And from a distance, you just see matters slipping away and A1C levels rising and trouble emerging. What's your thoughts on that?
Transition is a difficult area for a lot of families. We do see that in the teenage years, there's a lot more DNAs. Children not brought to clinic. There is a lot more missing insulin doses, a lot more DKAs during the teenagers. Children and young people start their transition process at 16 years of age, and they tend to move to the adult services from 18 to 19 years of age. So we do find that these young adults are being lost during this transition. And because there's lack of workforce, these young people are often lost for many years until they're more grown up. They want to look after their bodies better, then they return back to the adult services. So at the moment, I would say that the UK teams are struggling with their transition. It sounds like it happens in South Africa too. So there are initiatives trying to tackle that. And one of the initiatives that I think a lot of teams are trying to do is to get the adult healthcare professionals, the nurses, the doctors, the dietitians, to join the pediatric teams in their clinic appointments. And it's a way to introduce the children and young people to the adult teams and then hoping that they create some kind of rapport and then they move on to the adult services. But I still see lots of teenagers don't attend these transition clinics. And yeah, the problem is still there. If there is a very good initiative that you know of, please do share.
And likewise.
Yeah.
That whole idea of transition, I think for many healthcare professionals, is just not even on their radar.
Yeah.
We certainly see that in many South African settings. And I think what I'm hearing from you, Jesse, is that you generally tend to see the same clients over and over. You are, in effect, their dietitian. Am I correct?
Yeah. So at the moment, on top of my NHS England job, I also locum at another diabetes team. And yeah, I have 314 children and young people living with type 1 diabetes. About 10% of them have type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I am their dietitian. Yeah, it's great. Love it.
That's something that is missing from many clinics in South Africa, where you get to see the doctor or the dietitian or the nurse that is there that day.
Yeah.
And in that kind of clinic management, the opportunity to manage transition is lost entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can only transition if you understand the before and the after and the journey in between.
Yeah.
And I'd like to also raise the point that transition is not only from adolescence to adulthood, but if we look at Erik Erikson's 8 stages of psychosocial development, it's from the stage of trust versus mistrust, 0 to 6 months, to autonomy versus guilt and shame and self-doubt in the toddler, and so on. So you've got to manage each transition within itself. And if we just focus on transition as adolescence to adulthood, we're missing all the other transitions in between. As an example, when I used to see young children, let's say 7-year-olds who are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, the 7-year-olds didn't have a problem. The mom had the problem. She was dissolving in tears.
Mm.
And there's no judgment there, quite rightly. But I'm saying that the child was, okay, Ma, this is okay.
Yes.
Whereas if I saw a 13 or 14-year-old diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, the child was the rebel and the mom didn't know how to handle it. So maybe just give your experience in handling those other transitions across diabetes care and across the age ranges.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. Newly diagnosed at the different ages, I am usually very involved at diagnosis the first 2 months or so. And what I see with the different age groups is that parents are super into wanting to learn about the whole diabetes, how to manage carbohydrates, how to manage exercise. So usually it is a prime time to be doing education and creating that relationship with the families. with the toddlers, we do find the transition from being able to eat and drink whenever they want to now match it to all the insulin that they need to have with their milk, with their food, the main meals, with their snacks. It's a lot more structured. And also, it's hard to predict whether a toddler will finish that snack or finish that main meal. Then we'll have to talk to families, parents about maybe splitting the doses, how to split the doses. And some toddlers might be very averse to insulin injections. Then we might be talking about, okay, maybe we need to start a hybrid closed loop as soon as we can, starting CMS as soon as we can because they don't like the finger pricks. So in terms of differences at diagnosis, there are these nuances like managing food and giving insulin and testing glucose levels. I think the biggest transition I see at diagnosis is needing to be much more structured with food. And what I have found through my years of practice is that from the get-go, we do talk about the recommended meal pattern, you know, from 5 years onwards, so three main meals and one carbohydrate-containing snack time, if necessary. So they do know that message from the beginning. And I find that tends to help with setting their expectations with living with diabetes for the rest of their lives. I think the older way of teaching is, oh, as long as you carb count, as long as you give insulin, it's fine. But we do know now that it's really not that easy. Yeah.
I remember the stories in the days when we were still exclusively reliant on finger stick testing for young kids. Certain medical aids in this country for people under the age of 18 make provision for continuous glucose monitoring at little to no cost. But Michael, how often was it that these toddlers were eating with their hands, had their finger pricks done without having cleaned their hands? And you'd have all the fruit juice.
Absolutely.
And you'd have a panicking parent on with an HI or high. Some machines was above 32 millimoles. And you would just calmly say, don't clean the hands, dry the hands, test again.
Yeah.
It just makes me think that even in the adult setting, we've all had some kind of engagement with the pediatric population. But the consistent component there remains the parent or the primary caregivers who are involved, whether it's a single parent or two parents involved. And unfortunately, in South Africa, you spoke of human rights. Jesse spoke of economic pressures and work commitments. We have a large portion of grandparents who are providing care and need to be included in that team as well. We've spoken about the school teachers. And in fact, given that many of these kids spend the largest part of their day away from their parents, whether it be in the primary or the secondary education component, having teachers who've been well-trained and versed is a blessing as well, because it gives that degree of comfort and confidence to the parents to send their kids to school, knowing that they're going to be well looked after and somebody can tend to those alarms or if the behavior of the child changes. Michael, it's been an incredibly packed show, and I just want to fire off two quick thoughts for our expert guest here today. One is that celiac disease is very common in the UK. It is less common in South Africa, but the healthcare providers, everybody who's newly diagnosed with type 1 diabetes ought to be screened for celiac disease. That's a must. It occurs, we're not picking it up, and it may be one big component to why diabetes management may remain suboptimal. It may also account for a lot of GIT symptoms, such as constipation, ongoing diarrhea, growth stunting in the pediatric population. And then just one more question for you, Jesse. What kind of red flags do you pick up in the older child? Perhaps the child who's ready to transition, about early features of eating disorders that may be emerging. Just share with our audience here today some of those early clues that don't necessarily give us diagnosis, but just tell you this is a child that needs to be watched a little bit more carefully, a little bit more introspection, so that we don't miss these early clues for what may become a major mental health problem.
So that's a very interesting topic. It is pretty hot at the moment over here with eating disorders in diabetes. What I would say is that we know that disordered eating is more common in teenage girls than teenage boys, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. So we'll look out for long-term high blood glucose levels, missing insulin doses. We might even look into if a child or young person does not come into clinic for long periods of time, we'll also find out from their GPs whether they're collecting their insulin prescriptions. So we will try and engage as much as possible with a young person in the teenagers, especially if they have high HbA1c and they showing that they maybe need more support with their diabetes. So just to answer your questions, what I would look for is high glucose levels, significant weight loss, non-engagement with the clinic. And those are the three big things that I would look at.
Right. And then one quick fire question from my side with your role with technology. I don't believe that technology is the panacea for all things in diabetes.
Yes.
And Stan has made it very clear on previous episodes of this podcast that we view technologies such as continuous glucose monitoring as enablers to make things easier if you have the right approach to the management. So maybe with things like data overload and things like that being in mind, just give us your quickfire tips for making technology successful.
Yes, data overload is a big problem. And the biggest thing is showing families and children and young people how to use these technologies is super important. There are all these alarms in the CGMS or the hybrid closed loop systems. We need to understand the families and then adjust these alerts accordingly. So the default on CGMS or hybrid closed loop, I think for highs is maybe 10 or 14. But if you have a teenager with a HbA1c of 10, having a high alert of 14 is going to mean the alert will be going off all day long.
It's unrealistic, yeah.
So making sure that alerts are set realistically and then moving them down if necessary is one of the strategies that I use. Also, at the moment, we know that insulin pump therapy doesn't improve clinical outcomes compared to MDIs, but we know that hybrid closed loop systems, it has better clinical outcomes. So that's what we're pushing at the moment in the UK, to increase access to hybrid closed loops for all children and young people. In terms of looking out for their mental health, making sure that these families are prepared to have these technologies on them 24/7 is also setting expectations, using a shared decision-making tool to understand whether the families will benefit clinically and mental health-wise with these technologies. So, yeah, I think there is good and bad for sure.
As you said, Stan, it has been a packed show. I think, Jesse, we've only, as usual, scratched the surface of the potentially expanded role of a diabetes specialist pediatric dietitian.
Yes.
But thank you for giving us some insight into what you do and your role. Mm-hmm. And I hope that it piques some interest in healthcare practitioners to find out more and maybe how to provide better care for their young people who have diabetes. And also for people with diabetes to know that maybe there's a level of insight we should be demanding above what I'm currently getting.
Michael, I will say this. I think all too often the registered dietitians in South Africa get a bad rap because there has been a perception and there remains a perception of perhaps a punitive approach to weight loss that was entrenched from the favorable Scarsdale diets and the sort back in the early 1980s.
Right.
And the field of dietetic medicine is immense. It encompasses, as I've alluded to earlier, the nutrition component, the economic component, the social, the cultural, the spiritual, the family, the psychology. Nutrition isn't just about what's on the plate and how it got there, who's consuming it, where they're consuming it, all of the above. Mm. But I just want to share very quickly, tongue in cheek, we've spoken at many of our professional meetings, those populations and communities who enjoy shared platters. Somebody spoke about the Moroccan family who was sharing from a large platter of lamb and rice. You know, how do you carbohydrate count when 8 or 10 people are sitting around, perhaps at the end of Ramadan now, and sharing an evening meal? That's where the registered dietitian's knowledge comes to the fore. So for listeners out there and healthcare providers, make sure that you keep your dietitians close to you and that you are extracting the value for which they are there. They're not there to serve in a punitive component of draconian approaches to nutrition, which is really no longer suitable in the modern day for diabetes management. Jesse, thank you for your expert specialist knowledge as our first pediatric specialist dietitian to join us today. Thank you for giving up your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been really nice talking to you guys.
To our listeners out there, remember, you can find us on our 4 social media platforms. You are also welcome to share your questions, thoughts, and your own experiences with dietetic services or any aspects of diabetes management you want to share. We're at podcast@cdediabetes.co.za. I will catch everybody on the next show, and we'll leave it to Michael to sign us out for this week.
Thank you, Stan. Thank you, Jesse. And remember that our email address is podcast@cdediabetes.co.za. And we will be with you again next week. Over and out from us. Here's a reminder that this episode is brought to you by the CDE Online Pharmacy and the new range of CDE MyWell Reduced Calorie products. These shakes contain high-quality natural ingredients, and importantly, they offer 22 grams of protein per serving. Adequate protein intake during weight loss preserves lean body mass and controls appetite. They are also high in fiber and are nutritionally complete, providing all the essential vitamins and minerals. CDE recommends that individuals using CDE MyWell Reduced Calorie products should do so under the supervision of a VLCD-trained healthcare professional. Our CDE Academy Very Low Calorie Diet, or VLCD course for healthcare professionals, provides an insightful and practical guide on how to implement a VLCD program. Check out the links to both the products and the CDE Academy VLCD course in the show notes below. Thank you for joining us on Not Artificially Sweetened, where we aim to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Anything we discuss is for your reflection, education, personal growth, and entertainment only. You join this podcast at your own risk, and we are not responsible for any omissions, errors, or unwanted medical outcomes. Please note the following important, specific disclaimers. For people with diabetes, the health professionals on this podcast are not your personal caregivers. Always discuss any new information with your diabetes team before acting on any aspect of it. The views and opinions discussed are those of the hosts only and do not represent those of any other entity. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you encounter in this session. Anything you learn or experience here cannot substitute for personalized, professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For health professionals working in diabetes, always discuss any new information with your clinical team before acting on any aspect of it. You are personally accountable and liable for any choices made in a clinical setting according to your level of training and legal scope of practice. Any information or insights gained here must be used with your professional discretion and with the developing base of clinical evidence, local and organizational laws, regulations, guidelines, and protocols. Good luck with your diabetes care missions. Till next time.